Good morning, everyone. Let me call the study session of Thursday, March 13th, 2008 to order. I do notice that we have Alex Finter and Dave Richens in the audience, and I believe also probably Dennis Cavanaugh is watching on Channel 11. I want to congratulate you for winning your council district races and looking forward to your participation in the budget sessions and also on June 2nd being sworn into office. So congratulations to you. The first item this morning is to review items on the agenda for the March 17th, 2008 regular council meeting. I will be absent during that meeting, so I'd like to turn over the discussions of the agenda to the Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. And I just want to announce that I have a daughter who contacted me. We do a March Madness in our tournament every year in our family, and she contacted me 2 weeks ago and said, "Mom, in light of the campaign, are we going to have March Madness in our family?" And I want to announce that thanks to the voters of Mesa, there will be a March Madness tournament in the Walters household. So, all right, we're moving on to Monday, March 17th agenda. And I've got a blue agenda. That hasn't changed, has it, Chris? Okay. All right. Anything on page 2? Page 3? All right. Minor plan amendments. Public hearings, we're going on. I'm skipping past page 4 unless somebody yells. Page 5, got approving an ordinance that was introduced to the previous meeting. Liquor license applications, nothing. Page 6. Page 7, starting to get into the contracts. Page 8. More contracts. Page 9. This is going to be a fast council meeting you're missing, Keno. Page 9, introduction of ordinance and setting April 7th as the date. Page 10.
Yeah,
oh, sure. Slow me down. Go ahead.
But 8I, I think the mayor had a conflict, but he's not going to be here, so do we want to put that on consent?
It's on consent on my agenda.
Okay.
8I?
Mine is X'd off. That was just a note.
Okay, right. So it's going to stay on consent because Keno isn't going to be here. All right, we'll move on to page 10.
Do we have any signs that night?
Thanks.
Are there 10 freeway landmark signs on here? No, yeah. No, we can get that changed. Page 11. Did any of you read this agenda? No.
Yeah.
Page 12. Starting on page 12, we're actually approving ordinances that were introduced at prior council meetings. And 11B.
Vice Mayor, let me ask a question. I'm going to be absent, but on 10G, this is the cost sharing for the flood control area. It's $4.2 million. I remember the discussions originally out at Spook Hill area, I believe it is, but I haven't seen any of the charts on which project was going to be done, and because of the magnitude of this, I know that I think it's like a $16 million project, and that's our share, but it's still a huge amount of money. Has staff reviewed that to make sure that we still want to participate with the budget that we're in right now? Is this still a priority project? Would we lose the county money or the matching money if we didn't do it?
Good morning, Mayor, Council Members. I'm Kelly Jensen, Assistant City Engineer. Beth is off today. We have reviewed this and coordinated with the Flood Control District, and this is one of our priority projects for storm drainage in the area. It's got a basin and a large storm drain for the area. And so the question is, would we lose?
Well, was the right-of-way already purchased? Did we buy the right-of-way, or is that part of the $12 million cost? Because I remember seeing a lot of maps, and I can't remember which project this one was.
And the new basin that's shown on the exhibit on Haas Road has been purchased by the county, and that is part of this project.
Okay. And what was the total magnitude of the stormwater improvements in that area in order to keep the sheeting off from the mountains out there? I guess it's Usury Mountain that drains through there. Seemed like it was in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Is that accurate?
I don't
Because it has to be backed up before it hits the CAP canal.
Yeah, Mayor, maybe we could next week, even Monday, give a presentation, get an update, because it's been, I would say, 3 years since we really talked about this.
Yeah, I just, when I see something of $4.2 million, I want to make sure that that's been rethought.
It's very integral to the complete northeast area, I'm sure of that. But we could go back and give a presentation and show the map.
Yeah, and I would be particularly interested in what lands have been acquired to accommodate, because that's going to be the biggest, I mean, you can always probably put it in later when your road improvements are all built, but if you don't have the land out there, so that was my key on it, too. All right. Okay.
Let me ask a follow-up question on this, Kelly. Is storm sewer bonds that are already approved, are they already sold?
Is the info here that they already sold?
They would have to be.
Okay, I guess they are sold.
So the bonds have already been sold.
We're going to do the balance.
You know what? You have to come up because we can't hear you from back there.
We're doing the balance. There is some that had already been issued, so we will be issuing the balance. We're running those numbers right now, so I don't have the final total for you.
Will you
I
have
just
that
got those numbers on my desk yesterday.
Will you have that on Monday?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And just as an update, we did meet with the flood control district several times over the past year and reprioritize, you know, the projects and when what year they're going to be constructed. And so this one did move up a couple of years after we met and prioritized all the projects.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anything else on, we're on page 12 now, on 11B. That's off the consent agenda. You want to talk to us about it, John?
Vice Mayor, it's off consent because Councilmember Schrute will have a conflict on it.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that. Thank you. Schrute conflict. All right. Anything else on page 12? Page 13, we have a design review board case, 13A. This is being appealed by. Do you want to talk to us about that, John?
Yes, Vice Mayor, I can give you a little bit of background, and Leslie Davis from our design review staff can come up to help fill in any details. But this is a case out in southeast Mesa, south of the airport on the south side of Pecos Road, just north of the Queens Park area. Queens Park neighbors have appealed the design review board decision on this case, wanting to see some things slightly different on the site plan to address some of their concerns.
This is the same parcel as we just had a vote on.
That's
this
correct.
Is the Prop 300 vote that passed. This is the design review case on it that's being appealed.
That's correct.
Okay, I want to clarify that for everybody.
Vice Mayor, John, let's clarify, though, that what is being appealed, the proposal by the developer or something else?
What's being appealed is the decision by the design review board. There were some things that were on the site plan the developer put there in response to some of the questions or concerns of the neighbors. Design review board, and they're looking at it and determined some of those things should be modified. And I think that's largely the basis then of the neighbors' appeal, is to bring it back to what some of the agreements have been that they had with the developer.
Okay, so the developer and the neighbors are sort of on the same page on this one, or at least they had reached an agreement. The design review board altered that, and now the altered case is being brought to us.
Vice Mayor, I believe that's correct.
All right. So everybody want to take a good close look at that. Okay. Anything else on page 13? All right. Thank you. Thanks, Kim.
Item number two is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the Southeast Mesa Strategic Development Plan.
Mayor, Vice Mayor, good morning. I'm here with Mark McLaren from HDR. Been working further on the plan for the Mesa Gateway area. We have before you this morning a draft of the land use plan, and Mark's going to present that to you this morning, and then I'm going to wrap up a little bit at the end. So, Mark, I'll go ahead and turn it over to you.
Thank you, John. Mayor, members of the council, I'd like to provide you with a briefing this morning on the status of the development of the Mesa Gateway strategic plan. You will recall we have a vision that we had identified as a group last October to help us guide us through this process in terms of what we would like to ultimately achieve for the area. understanding that our most significant challenge was input from all of you, that we create an area that would provide the opportunity for the creation of 100,000 high-quality, high-wage jobs by 2030, while protecting the operations at the airport, as the airport is obviously critical to the success of the area. In December, we came to you with three different land use scenarios that were reviewed as a part of a workshop. At that time, the concepts ranged from one that was much more different in terms of a mixed-use environment with some very significant urban centers in our Concept A to our Concept C, which was one that was more consistent with what was currently in the city's general plan, with a lot of emphasis for industrial uses around the airport area. We had evaluated each of those in terms of infrastructure, in terms of operations and maintenance costs over time, as well as the transportation impacts, and looked at the fiscal impact of each of those alternatives. And based on the input of Fishkind and Associates, our fiscal analysts that are part of this team, had determined that probably somewhere between our Concept A, which was the much more dense alternative, and Concept C, which was the one with more industrial, somewhere between those two was probably the most reasonable accommodation to address those concerns and make sure that it's a plan that's fiscally viable. We had a number of comments from the participants who were there to participate with us in the reviewing of those three concepts. There was a lot of favorable response to the idea of increased density, as well as some of the mixed use and urban cores that we had within that area. There was also a strong interest in having some significant open space and linked open space between the areas, the reference being given to us by a number of participants of something akin to the Indian Bend Wash area in Scottsdale. And also that people recognize the fact that in order to really achieve the goal of being a high-end destination urban center with a lot of urban character, that we had to have a lot of residential to provide those opportunities within the area. The direction as we finish that workshop, as well as input from all of you and the stakeholders who have been involved in the process, gave us some very strong direction on a couple of issues that we needed to be cognizant of as we went through the refinement of the plan, looking at obviously the concerns of Boeing and how we integrate the various land uses around the airport with the types of operations that they have and what the airport foresees as future flight operations in that location. Interest and direction that we avoid detached housing adjacent to freeways, and also looking at opportunities for some higher density residential in appropriate areas throughout the study area. Again, with the interest and the intent of having 100,000 high-wage, high-value jobs, we were looking at building on the assets that exist in the area, and particularly the asset of the airport itself. And we came back to you for a briefing at the end of January and discussed kind of the opportunities and the various growth patterns that have occurred around the Ontario and John Wayne airports in California, and the very different character of land use development that exists within those areas. Ontario Airport being a very low density, very much focused on warehouse and manufacturing environment, with a significant number of jobs, but most of those jobs all being focused in construction and manufacturing fields, as highlighted on the screen. We also looked at the John Wayne Airport area, smaller study area, but much higher density in terms of the land uses that exist in close proximity to that airport and the operations that occur there on a daily basis. Again, looking at the same listing of industries, a couple of different industries that are very significant in terms of the types of employment of high-wage jobs in the John Wayne area, understanding that the mix of uses and things that occur there with finance and some of the other employment opportunities are also drawing upon the opportunity for a lot of mid to high density residential that makes up a part of that land use in close proximity to the airport. The net effect of those two airports is that while John Wayne has a significantly higher number of jobs within the area around its airport, it does so in a much smaller area of land. So the ratio of jobs in that area is significantly higher. The advantage that we have within the area of the Mesa Gateway Airport is the opportunity to draw on the advantages and the benefits of both of those patterns of development that exist around the John Wayne and the Ontario airports, with an emphasis of office and high-wage jobs to the north and northeast of the Gateway Airport, and then to the south and the southeast, kind of following more of the lower-density warehouse and industrial character that you see in the area around the Ontario airport. In understanding the need to have residential as a part of the mix to make this area achieve its success in terms of being a new urban center with this opportunity for high-wage jobs in employment, we also took into consideration a lot of the trends in terms of what knowledge-based workers are looking for in terms of housing and lifestyle opportunities with a number of the types of companies that we would like to attract to the area, understanding that the housing market in terms of who's buying homes and what they're looking for is changing significantly as well as our demographics change and continue to evolve. And also looking at the fact that there are recent surveys that have shown that there's an increasing interest on the part of home buyers nationwide to look at higher density mixed-use communities for their housing options. In the character of the types of residential that we've been evaluating within the study area, we have, and will provide as a part of our report, some ideas on the different types of housing that can make up some of the higher density areas that we've identified on the map. And there's a couple of just quick examples here, ranging from townhome type development at about 20 units to the acre, along with low-rise multifamily with significantly higher yield at 40 units to the acre for that type of development, and also the idea of just some different forms of how that development can occur. This is a type referred to as an embedded garage multifamily. There's a project like this in Central Phoenix where from the street what you see is the multifamily housing and balconies and opportunity for retail and interface at the street level. That interior to that block, there's a parking garage to serve and meet the needs of the residents within that area. And then finally, also the opportunity for some higher-rise multi-family, again, consistent with some of the types of development that we've seen around some other airports, and particularly the type of housing that's serving some of the high-wage jobs in the area around John Wayne Airport. That brings us to the draft plan that we have prepared to respond to this information and the comments that we've received to date as we go through this. I would like to point out, as we look at the map, most of the land use categories that you see on the legend are consistent with some cases, some minor changes to what's in your current general plan. There is one new classification that we have added to the list, which on the right-hand column is kind of the royal blue color there, which is referred to as urban employment mixed use. And the intent here is to provide an employment-based business opportunity that's a higher density than what we might have as just a business park classification, and allow for a better transition between some of our higher density residential and higher density urban center areas to some of the other employment categories that would be located within the region. The plan is configured in such a way to respect and protect the opportunities of the airport, and specifically respond to the discussion that we had on January 31st in terms of flight patterns and flight activity in and out of the airport. You will notice that to the south of the alignment of Williams Field Road, we have respected the no-fly-friendly area that's there to the south. We have not included any other residential uses to the south of the 202 freeway or to the southwest of the Williams Gateway freeway, keeping the lower density single-family residential opportunities as much out of those flight patterns as possible to make them more compatible with the opportunities that would exist for development in the area. Probably most significant in the plan and responding to a lot of the feedback that we got from the workshop back in the time frame of our December presentations to you is the urban center that is identified in this plan, essentially at the intersection of Elliott and Ray Roads. This is what we really see as being the key node of activity within this area being a higher density, significantly mixed use urban core that would be the new downtown, if you will, for this area as the area begins to evolve and develop. In consideration of the goals that you had set for us in terms of population and employment, a couple of quick charts here to show you where we believe this plan takes us on a growth rate towards a timeline of 2030, as was identified for you as we initiated this process. As currently configured, we believe this plan is one that can achieve just over 120,000 jobs in the timeline of 2030, with approximately 38,000-39,000 housing units being developed within the area as well. This shows you kind of the distribution of the types of jobs that would be provided within the area. This is one that, again, gets to a good mix of jobs and particularly increases in the office categories those opportunities for the high-wage, knowledge-based jobs that were one of the goals that we wanted to achieve with the area. In terms of housing types, we have a housing blend here in terms of growth in the timeline of 2030. That is higher in terms of the categories of multifamily and townhouse. But as you look at the map and the various colors that are provided in there, we believe that it's really a good blend and mix of housing types that will make this area succeed as it develops over that timeline. In terms of our timeline for the study and this process as it continues, our goal is to come back to you in May with a plan and report for your approval. We are in the process now of refining the financial impact model that we had presented to you previously to evaluate the capital and operating costs associated with this plan and determine the fiscal impacts of it on the city and how those are addressed. We are also in the process of refining the transportation model so that we understand the roadway networks and the infrastructure that are necessary on that 2030 horizon to be considered within the plan, and we will be coming back to you in May for consideration of that information. John?
Thanks, Mark. Mayor, Vice Mayor, we've been starting to give some consideration to the transition period once this sub-area plan would be approved, and we have a plan that is somewhat different than the existing general plan in terms of the land uses and some of the categories and direction for the area. Approving the sub-area plan does not specifically alter the general plan. That's a separate step that would have to take place. So one of the things that we envision starting here fairly soon is some minor general plan amendments. One would be to add the new categories that Mark mentioned that are proposed in this plan that we don't currently have in the general plan. We'd need to add those so they would be available for use. And then we'd also need to look at the current general plan criteria for what constitutes a major plan amendment in this area. You may recall that a year or so ago we amended the general plan to say any change from employment to residential was automatically a major plan amendment. I think we'll need to revisit that based on some of the land use categories we're proposing out there and see if we need to change any of those definitions. In addition, we will, again in the short run, potentially have some requests come in that are consistent with the sub-area plan, what the council's latest approvals, that may not be consistent with the general plan. And so we'll need to evaluate each of those and assist the applicants in any changes that might be needed in terms of minor plan amendments to help their cases move on through the process. If we happen to get cases that somebody submits that are consistent with the general plan but not consistent with the sub-area plan, then we'll have to evaluate those. And again, we would suspect we'd be recommending conformance with the recently adopted sub-area plan and encouraging the applicants to follow that when there's a difference in that way. And then finally, we'll also be reviewing the need for a major general plan amendment for the area to be filed by staff in 2009, working with the property owners once we can fully evaluate the differences between the sub-area plan and the general plan to see if that would be necessary to bring forward in the following year to bring both plans in full harmony with each other.
Good questions? Vice Mayor.
John, one of the concerns that I have is that as you move forward, this is reliant on having heights that are of a minimum level in order to achieve this. Once you start building housing, then you end up with people who are saying, you know, we don't want those kind of heights. I'd like to see a structure, something in here that that sets minimum height requirements for the area so that you don't have, you can't have people coming back in and saying, well, if you chose to, you could make it some lower number. I want it to be a very difficult process to actually make it a lower height level. Otherwise, we risk ending up with just more of the same of what we already have around the community.
Yes. Mayor, Vice Mayor, that's a very good point. And the timing on this is very good as we're working on our zoning ordinance. So we'll be able to share this information with our consultant there and put those standards in place that will help give the comfort level that we will achieve those minimums we're really after.
And you know, given the other things, you probably need to set a maximum too. That would, you know, but a minimum and a maximum so that we have that range.
Yes.
So we don't end up with the NIMBYism that you know. I think regardless of the survey that you showed us, people like that someplace else. You know, they like the concept of a lot of things, but a lot of times they don't want it next to them.
The area from Sossaman to Hawes, just south of Elliott Road, has what I look at as kind of an orange. The corners are Village Center, I believe. What is the other area in there that's that lighter orange, just around that green open area? Is that high-density residential is what's the depiction
Mayor and
on
Council,
the map?
Yes, that the pale orange that is in that area to the south of Elliott, between Sossaman and Haas, around the green open space that's been identified there, is designated as high density residential.
Okay. Knowing that the noise contours, there's a little bubble off to the right there, and I think that's probably from that fly-friendly turn that turns off to the east and follows the power line. How does that work with aviation flights flying over it? In that area, I'm trying to superimpose what the traffic pattern would be, and that didn't seem like an appropriate location for that type of a residential. So, what was your thought process, or the thought process when that came up?
We had identified within this area the need, and obviously, as we've had one of our goals of balancing jobs and housing within the area. And based on the evaluation that was done with city staff of the flight pattern information provided by Sky Harbor Airport and looking at the patterns in and out of the area, we felt that by the time that departing aircraft have reached this location, both in terms of height on their departure angle, as well as the noise based on this contouring that's shown within here, that this was one of the areas where we might be able to achieve some limited level of high-density residential to help provide a better mix within the area. Understanding that high-density residential is the one that is most compatible with the higher levels of noise that would be realized with the proximity to the airport.
Okay. If I was looking at the map, I'd probably move that residential to some other component. Having flown out of there and made that right corner, I can almost visualize what I'm going to be flying over the top of, and I'd rather not do that. I think there's enough land out there. The other thing, this is a little bit in isolation. I know that there's some high-density residential that's already in Gilbert along the other side of Power Road. So if we're looking, and I understand having residential close enough to the job center, but I think that Gilbert has already provided a lot of high-density residential, and I'm not sure that that's an appropriate location. I really want to make sure that this airport's protected, and I think that some of those, especially to the north as those planes are turning, are going to be impacted long-term, and it's going to be harder to make Gateway viable. So I really question that location. And then when and I'm trying to remember exactly what the existing general plan indicates, but when we go further to the east, south of Elliott Road, and I'm looking probably from Ellsworth over to Signal Butte, you have another circle on that map, and I assume that's an urban center which would have a mixed use of residential and the rest in there too.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And that's going to be quite a change from our existing general plan, because I think that's now considered as employment or industrial. So
I believe in your current general plan, it is designated as an industrial use. In the briefing and information we had provided as a part of our discussion on January 21st, or I'm sorry, 31st, one of the things that we had shown was that based on the evaluation of the flight track data from Sky Harbor Airport, the predominance of the departing flights were actually in the area to the north of Elliott Road. It's a wide fan as it gets out to that location, obviously, but the majority of the flights were occurring to the north of that location, which is why from the area between essentially the top of the study area or the power lines and Elliott Road, we've maintained the non-residential uses within that corridor.
Okay, and the green that you have indicated, it's either Gulf or open space just to the east of that from Chrisman to Signal Butte. Would there be houses blanketing the sides of that, or would that be a non-residential area completely?
As it's intended in the way that it is shown in the green on the map to the east end towards Signal Butte, the residential would be to the south of it. It would not be within the green area.
Okay. The yellow to the south of that and the higher density in that area, I completely support. And the higher the density, the better. Because I think that that little V in the airport is a perfect place for higher density residential. So I think you've got that. I just question some of the other locations where the village centers and high density residential are being placed, because I think we're going to have a conflict with the airport, the number of overflights in those areas. So that would be my caution to this existing map as it's drawn today.
Okay.
Other comments? Tom?
Your slide that talked about the national survey of 6 out of 10 prospective home buyers preferring higher density. Any kind of survey done in Arizona to find out what the Arizona home buyers want versus what the national mood is? Because I think there's a little different perception in Arizona as to the desirability of higher density versus somebody who's living in New Jersey or Manhattan.
Understood. And I am not aware of a survey that has been specific to this market. Again, that is a national survey that information was provided on.
How about regional? Any kind of regional study?
Not to a statistic that I could quote this morning.
Because I'm concerned about a 7-to-1 ratio to higher density residential versus single family residential. I think if the idea here is to attract, make this a boardroom instead of just a bedroom community, we want to supply these high jobs, paying jobs. We want the people who are in those high-paying jobs to live in the same area. The people who are making that kind of money are not going to want to live in multi-family or higher-density residential. So I'm not sure that we're being totally consistent in what we're hoping for here. And I think the 7-to-1 ratio is skewed way too much in favor of high-density residential versus single-family.
Lieutenant Scott.
On the flight patterns or noises from the airport, and making sure that this plan is compatible, I had the opportunity to visit the Decision Theater at Arizona State University, and they were working with Dubai in the construction of their new airport. And I remember some slides there. They entered in some data, flight patterns, geographical features, construction features into their computer, and what you have is a visualization of the airport, the residential, where all the uses are, and it would show the aircraft coming in or taking off, and beneath it what the sound levels were. And I'm wondering if before we make a decision on this and where things are supposed to go, if there's a way that we can partner with the landowners here, the business community, and Arizona State University, and get us into the Decision Theater and plot this in with those numbers, the types of aircraft, the noise, and see what the flights look like, because not only does it take into account where they go, but altitudes and how big their engines are and the amount of noise they put out, and then we can really put some data into the decisions. What are the possibilities, maybe, Mr. Brady, or John that we could do something like that?
Mayor, Councilman Summers, we've actually talked about that, I think, at your earlier suggestions, and we think it'd be a wonderful idea, because one of the things that we did, if the council recall, in the exercise we did with the air track overlays, is we also tried to superimpose, from, if you look at John Wayne, where do those tall buildings stand, and some of those are embedded with residential, where do they stand in relationship to the end of their runway, with superimposing that here and that exercise. And that's where you see these proposed land uses are consistent with what we see around Tempe, around Sky Harbor, both in Tempe and Phoenix, whether it's also in John Wayne. So we've tried to be very careful to create the balance of mix that allows for the airport to be successful, and even looking at current day practices of airports that are successful, that do have some element of high density residential, but always understanding that that needs to be fine-tuned. But it would be probably very helpful. I think it was helpful for the council to see the modeling that we did out at the airport, and we could maybe, I guess, we could try to bring all that together now with these land uses, and maybe take these land uses and kind of build them up in a model with the heights and types of buildings, and work on that and bring that back to council, or I guess we would have to go there to the council, to the decision theater maybe, and do that. So I think that's something, Mark, we had talked about possibly doing kind of at the as we get closer to the end of the process here. And I don't know if you've had any follow-up opportunities to think more about that, but I mean, that's something we have talked about doing.
Yes, it is certainly one of the tools that we can use to help tell the story in terms of how the land uses are compatible with both the flight patterns in and out of the airport, as well as the noise contours that are shown.
I think it's fair to say that based on these patterns, the height issue is manageable with the different uses. Height is not the concern with any of the uses that are being proposed here, with the current data that we have regarding the departure of airplanes going out of the airport today. So the question then becomes is, how do you mitigate for noise? And we believe that I think part of the effort here was the reason we were proposing the higher density is that you don't have residents standing out in their backyards where they're exposed to the noise of the airport. But again, as you can see, there's no proposal of any use inside any of the contours. And yet we've shown in a variety of instances, even Sky Harbor, there are residential developments that are being built within those contours. But again, I think we can mitigate some of that in the future and adoption of noise, programs or construction materials and things like that. But again, getting to your question, I think we would like to see if we could accommodate something at the decision theater, kind of building off the model we've already developed for council to look at, and maybe populate this with heights and types of uses and see what it feels like.
Right. And get the three-dimensional element to
right.
this, because we draw lines on a map all day, and it never seems to me, when we're in these discussions, that the lines that we draw, somebody always says, well, that's not the real line. So when we have a wonderful technology available at a university nearby, I think we should put that on the front burner and turn up the heat a little bit and try to get that done in the next 2 months and see if we can't get in front of that and utilize that asset to make solid decisions here about what is and is not possible or a good idea. I gotta say, overall, sharing some of the concerns of the mayor, and which is why I brought that up. Overall, I like how this is turning out, particularly when you look to the south. Everything seems to be very much in agreement with all that fun we had with Boeing. Are they still on board, by the way? Boeing has been participating in this and has seen this so far. Where are we with those folks?
They have been invited to a meeting that we will have with stakeholders tomorrow to go through this discussion that we've had with you this morning in this plan.
And then I believe DMV was talking to Boeing. They've been involved privately on the side too. All right. Well, but to the south, it looks really good, and so I'm pleased with that.
The decision theater concept would be great if that could be set up. If they could also model the inside and the outside noise with different sound attenuation, so we know what the ordinance actually physically has a difference. And I'm pretty sure they can do that through their different way they adjust their speaker volumes.
Oh, okay.
So see if they can at least. So I think that would be a nice nice dimension to it. Other questions or comments? Mr. Truitt.
Looking at the urban center that you have down there at Ellsworth.
Ray, I think that's the one you said you added to the plan. Just kind of looking at it, I assume you're at least indicating some sort of couplet system for Ellsworth Road itself?
Yes.
Okay.
And this urban center that is shown there at Ellsworth and Ray, in our original concept A, which we had reviewed in December, that activity was on the west side of the freeway in front of the airport. And while there was a lot of interest in the idea of having that urban center there as a part of the plan, there was also an interest in having it located on the other side of the freeway to the east so that it was further from the airport.
Thanks.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, what's the program to bring this forward, and what action does this council have, and what action will the next council be expecting?
John, the time we're continuing to develop the plan, we still need to go back to stakeholders.
Right.
We need to refine some of, I think, the transportation elements of it. I don't know, and there's a financing component. What are the remaining pieces, I guess? That's maybe. And then the idea was to bring this to council in May, I believe.
Is that correct?
As far as the final, but Mark can tell a little bit more detail about
it. Yeah, and I'm sorry, I guess I misunderstood the question, Mayor. In terms of the timeline right now, we are refining the fiscal impact model, which we had presented to you earlier, to evaluate the long-term operations and capital costs for the area, understand what the costs are that we need to look at funding sources for as a part of the program. We are updating the transportation model so that we understand the roadway network that needs to be in place to support the development on the 2030 horizon with the forecast that we have for jobs and housing in that timeline. And in doing so, then we'll complete the plan along with the narrative inclusive of the description of land uses and the general plan updates that go with it to return to you in a May timeline for approval.
Okay, so the general plan update would be what this council... it's going to be a major plan change, so the time frame on that is you get one shot each year to do that with all of them. So that's actually, what, November? And that, so it gets through this council on the submittal, and then the new council does the approval or go through that again for
it? Yes. Mayor, what will happen is that there are a couple of minor plan amendments that I think will process here fairly quickly, but still will probably hit the next council because we'll actually need to adopt this plan in May, and then based on that, do some minor tweaks. But if there is a need to do a major plan amendment, we've missed the time frame for this year, so we'll have to file that in 2009, and so it will be considered fully by the new council.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go on then to number three is here, presentation, discuss, and provide... discuss the proposed funding recommendation for fiscal year 08-09 for a variety of programs. Everybody, bring it. If you have any questions, we'll ask Kyle.
They need to stay away from this.
Oh, you did?
One on each side of the table.
All right.
Sure.
I'm not good at this.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Ray Villa, the Neighborhood Services Director. With me, I have Carolyn Olson, the Housing and Revitalization Director, and Scott Clapp, Management Assistant in Housing and Revitalization. We're here this morning to present to you our annual proposal process for FY 08-09 CDBG Home and ESG programs. Carolyn will go ahead and do the presentation this morning.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. On our first slide there, it talks about the programs, our federal entitlement programs, the CDBG program, the home program, ADDI, and emergency shelter grant, ESG program. on the next slide lists the allocations that we've had and somewhat of a history with last year and this year's allocations and any difference that there are within those programs. You'll notice that we have had a decrease in the programs this year. The next slide talks about the eligible activities for our CDBG program, our Community Development Block Grant program, and you can see the list of those activities on that slide. Feel free to jump in if you have any questions concerning any of those.
Let me ask you on the decrease. Is the decrease because of the, was there a special census and the numbers for Mesa residents versus, or is it has to do with demographics, or how did the numbers go down?
The decrease is simply a federal decrease where when they did a decrease across the board on programs.
So it wasn't population related?
No, it had nothing to do with.
Just every city got
it was across the board decrease.
Vice Mayor.
Yes.
Carolyn, my understanding was that there are more entitlement cities now than there were before, though.
I think
as a result
two.
Of having more entitlement cities, that also impacts us.
At first, we got an allocation, and then they came back and said there was two more entitlement cities, so it did go down just a slight more, just maybe a couple hundred thousand. But it's basically was across the board cut federally.
What's an entitlement city?
It's a city of a certain population and criteria that the federal regulations have determined to be entitled.
And then they get more money?
It comes straight to them.
They get eligible.
It gets to be $50,000.
Smaller cities also get money, but they come through their states. And then they have to apply to states. Ours comes straight to the city because we're entitlement.
I'm not sure I want to understand it all. Okay, go ahead.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. Moving on to the page 5 slide, the home investment partnership, that funding creates affordable housing for low-income families. We are part of the Maricopa County consortium at this time, and that's where our home funds come through. The ESG funding, emergency shelter grant, those funds are for rehabilitation of our emergency shelter facilities here in Mesa, and we work in collaboration with our Human Service Advisory Board for the organizations that receive that particular funding. This year, we put a new process into place. We actually did web-based applications for our nonprofits to submit their applications. We'll have to do a few tweaks next year, but by and large, it went well. Their proposals were due to us on December 7th, and we did have our first public hearing on January 24th. Our second public hearing, as you know, was March 3rd, and currently we are in the 30-day comment period until March 24th. On April 7th, we will come back to the council for approval of projects and allocations for those projects. Any comments concerning any of the projects or allocations can come to me at that address that's listed there, Post Office Box 1466, Mesa, or can email me those or give me a call. Also, we're coming to the council pursuant to page 10 of your slide 10. We are wanting to amend the 2007 annual plan for CDBG funds in the amount of $26,000. And this is for a proposed relamping light fixture retrofitting for the senior center that over the years would save them considerable amount of money. This is proposed to us through our utilities department. And that would be an amendment to our 07 plan to use contingency funds for that. And the final slide just indicates the actions that will need to be taken by the council on all the city on all the projects that we are recommending at this time. And I believe with your report you did receive the breakdown and it's also in your book. So hang on to your book until the 7th. So if there's any questions or comments that might come to you, you will have the information that you need within the book. So I would open up to any questions.
Okay, questions? Tom?
Two areas. You may not be the ones to answer the first one. Chris may. Mesa Senior Center energy conservation reminds me to ask, how are we doing on the Mesa Senior Center energy issue?
Mr. Rawls, I believe I can answer that question. I've been working closely at the behest of Kerry Kent with our energy management coordinator here at the city, Nick DeSantis, and we, Nick had conducted a facility audit on the senior center, kind of trying to address some of the short and long-term strategies that can be employed to help them conserve energy and make the money that we pass through to them kind of go a little further and shorten that gap that they've been experiencing. To this date, we have had two meetings. Today, we're scheduled to have our third meeting to go over the quarterly amounts. Up until this time, I believe of the total amount, they've expended $57,000 in utility costs, and my projections have them as probably being very close to having not exceeding the allocation that we've given them. And if they do, it's going to be probably $3,000 to $5,000 over, where in past years, for example, last year they had a $39,000 overage, and the year before that they had $16,000 overage. So I believe that we've made some great strides in helping them be aware of some of the things that they can do, and also identifying some of the longer term strategies that do require investment by the city. So overall, I think we've made some good headway into strengthening this partnership.
Good. I'm glad to hear that, and just proves that things that get attention normally get resolved, and things that you don't know about just sort of drift. And so I appreciate the fact that everybody's been working on it, and hopefully we can keep that under control. The second issue is, and this is probably the wrong kind of market to ask this about, but I noticed that we have programs in here to help first-time home buyers, et cetera. And I'm just curious, do we have any kind of history as to how this mortgage foreclosure problem in the country is affecting people in this program? Are we finding a higher rate of foreclosure among these activists? Are these recipients of these funds, or are they not buying more home than they can afford and not really part of the problem?
Well, working with our partners with NEDCO, they have really done a good job in making sure that the home buyers are ready. They go over the documents with them so that the persons that go through our programs are as safe as we can help them be, with not having to go through any foreclosure actions.
Okay, are we experiencing any increase in foreclosures from previous loans?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, that's, as I said, I'm guessing it's a different market and a different class of buyer.
Right.
So I appreciate it.
We try to do a lot of homeowner education, and like I said, we have professionals within those organizations that do go over documents with the families for the first time, and so we do the best we can on those.
Yeah, well, there are normally professionals that go over the documents for people who buy the homes
well,
they can't afford as well. Right, no, I understand that.
Well, and Mayor and Councilman Rawls, this is actually a very good point, because I think that's one of the benefits of these programs is this first-time homebuyer's assistance, because so you have a third party who's really an advocate or helping the individual before they get into a mortgage to try to really make sure that they are prepared to do so,
right,
and that they have the ability to continue in the long term. So maybe this, frankly, is a program that should be done before someone goes and talks to a mortgage banker that's not necessarily looking after the best interests of the individual signing the papers.
So. Right. Thank you.
And it usually is done before they go.
Sorry. I appreciate it.
Professional what, Tom? you said professionals, and I'm saying professional what? So you're continuing to work with Housing Our Communities on this, that's our partner, Housing
Yes.
Our Communities?
Yes.
And when you put on here that of the things that have to take place, the actions that have to happen, the one about amending the 2007 plan, would that happen this Monday night? Are we adding that to the agenda?
It would be April 7th with the other
approvals.
Okay,
so that has to go through the hearing process as well?
Yes. because it's a new project that we didn't have anything like that on last year's plan, so we have to approve that through the 30-day comments.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Item number four is hear a presentation and discuss Falcon Field budget issues.
Jack, are we going to put up the, do you have this, the it's coming. Wheel? Can you bring me?
And identify the plane.
Here's the wrong percentage.
See the guy up in the tower? That's me.
Oh. Mayor and council and councilman-elect, let me, just before we begin the two presentations today, let me just remind the council that today we're going to hear from two departments that fall within what we call our utilities and enterprise fund operations. And what makes them a little distinctive is that in the totality of our all funds budget, which includes everything from bonds to the general fund, debt service, quality of life, the transportation, again, utilities, enterprise, you can see the chart that really today the group, that these two discussions from these two departments actually fall within that utilities and enterprise fund. The reason I make that distinction is that they are enterprises, so that they are required as a business practice to generate revenues to cover all of their expenses, including overhead. And in the case of solid waste, they also contribute to the utility fund transfer. For Falcon Field, they are wholly contained enterprise that generates all revenues generated at the airport stay on the airport as required by FAA. And so those are improvements. And the reason I want to make that distinction is with the a lot of discussion about the downturn in the economy and the challenges with our shortfall. These two departments are really not included in that context because they're outside the general fund. It is in the general fund that relies upon the sales tax receipts. That is where we'll be experiencing the most, we're experiencing the most significant pressure of shortfall in revenues. And we'll be talking more about that a week from today, but I just want to kind of set the stage that these really are enterprise funds, so they're a little bit different in the context of they aren't being affected by the discussions that we have regarding the shortfalls in the revenues.
And I think that has to be clarified a little bit because you can switch some money from the enterprise accounts over to the general governmental.
Except for, you can't do it, not with Falcon Field.
Not Falcon, but you can for...
Solid Waste does contribute, that's why I said, Solid Waste does contribute to the utility fund transfer to the general fund, yes. Right. So that is considered, but they're also a separate entity, like almost like water, gas, and electric, where they are a enterprise fund that generates revenue specifically for their operations. Okay?
Okay. I guess a question for Falcon Field and also probably at some point Gateway is in order to get federal money, what is the requirement as far as, I think Sky Harbor can actually, their retail sales, they can take off the airport, but anything that's aviation related on the field, they cannot. So I was curious if there's anything in that enterprise that all the lease revenue stays, the fueling stays, you know, hangar, all of that has to be reinvested back in the airport. Are there any parts of Falcon Field that can be revenue sources that can be transferred out?
Mayor, council members, the sales tax revenue that is collected off of those businesses at the airport can flow into the general fund, and it's my understanding that it currently does.
But Mayor, I would suggest to you that even Sky Harbor's contribution
to Gateway is restricted. They cannot make a contribution. For example, Sky Harbor does not make a contribution from Sky Harbor to the city of Phoenix to assist in their $60 million shortfall. It has to be aviation or aeronautical related, and I think that they've been able to make the case to the FAA that by contributing to Gateway, that helps out the regional aviation perspective. So I think that's the restriction. So I guess Gateway could contribute to Corinne's Falcon Field, or Falcon Field could contribute to Gateway. I don't know if he wants to go there. And I know that I've seen those models done before, but it's kind of restricted to the aviation business.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for allowing us to be here today, and it is exciting to see what is being planned for the Phoenix Mesa Gateway area. It's pretty fun, and it's going to be a great opportunity, I think, for Mesa in the future, and currently is. But today we're going to talk a little bit about Mesa's other airport, and that's Falcon Field Airport. Most of you know where it's located, up in the northeast area of town. And just to give you a big picture idea of what Falcon Field is currently doing, we currently have over 900 aircraft based at Falcon Field, which is one of the largest numbers of based aircraft at any airport in the United States. We have over 800,000 square feet of hangar space that has been constructed over the years, and we basically have a 100% occupancy rate at this point. There are 98 businesses located on the airport, and that accounts for approximately 1,300 jobs on the airport. The statistics as far as aircraft operations, and by aircraft operations I mean landings and takeoffs. In 2006, there are approximately 3,000 general aviation airports and private landing strips in the United States. And of those 3,000, in 2006, Falcon Field ranked number 12 in terms of the annual operations. In 2007, we had a 26% increase in our aircraft operations, and we ranked at number 4 in the United States with over 314,000 aircraft operations. During the month of January of this year, we actually exceeded everyone, and of those 3,000 airports, Falcon Field ranked number 1 in terms of operations that month. So we are a busy little place. In terms of our budget and where we stand as of 2007-2008, you can see the budget listed on the left-hand side and our projected actual. Actually, our revenues are coming in a little higher than we had originally budgeted for, and that's because of the fact that we've been leasing some ground. I'll talk about that in a minute. That is increasing our revenue. Just to back up briefly, the beginning balance was funds that were collected from the sale of some property near Wrecker and 202 that had been previously purchased with airport revenues. And so that gave the airport an opportunity to establish basically a fund balance that we can work with. But our revenues are coming in very strongly. We're holding our operating expenses to a manageable number. If you take the amount of capital funding that just the airport pays for without the federal and the state funding assistance, we are coming in a little lower under budget, just simply because some of the projects that we had budgeted for we're going to have to postpone because the federal and the state funding has not come through yet. So we are anticipating that by the end of this fiscal year, we will have an ending balance of approximately $5.1 million in the airport fund. And that is an increase of $786,000 over the beginning of the fiscal year. Now, I mentioned briefly the increase in the revenues that we've enjoyed, and part of that is because we have aggressively been marketing the vacant land at the airport to get it leased out. The decision was made a couple years ago that rather than the airport constructing additional development and hangar space, that we would lease the ground out to to the private sector and give the private sector the opportunity to construct the developments themselves, and then the city would enjoy the revenue off of the ground leases. This first map shows you where we were in October of 2005. We had approximately 95 acres of land that were not developed and were not leased at that point in time. And since that date, you have see the colored areas have been reduced substantially. We have leased over 65 acres of that land, and right now we only have about 30 acres left for development. Those two parcels that you see right there, the one on the right, we are currently in the process of designing a taxi lane to be constructed that will allow that particular parcel of land to have access to the runways and the taxiways. So leasing that land is going to be a couple years out until we get the taxi lane in. And then the rectangular one is basically, if this was a Monopoly table, that would be Broadway or Park Place. And that particular parcel is going to be, we're going to be master planning that parcel along with some developments with the air traffic control tower and future airport terminal buildings. So both of those parcels will be leased at some point, but not this next year. Just to give you a brief overview of some of the projects that we've been working on in 2007-2008, we have worked with over $2 million in federal and state grant funds during this fiscal year, and the list there just shows you some of the projects that we have been actively working on. In terms of our proposed budget for 2008-2009, excluding the federal and the state grants, again, we're looking at a beginning balance of approximately $5.1 million. Operating revenues, we're looking at coming in, again, that will be an increase over 07-08 of about $3.8 million because, again, of those higher lease revenues. Our operating expenses are going to be higher than what we had budgeted and experienced in 2007-2008, and that is partly because of a program that the state has had in the past to provide airports with funding to do pavement preservation projects. That funding is currently being held up in the state legislature and is not being disseminated to any airports. Unfortunately, we can't wait for those funds to come forward. We have pavement that needs to be maintained, and so we are anticipating at this point in next fiscal year and probably following fiscal years, a minimum of $600,000 in operating expenses to move forward with our pavement preservation program that had not been previously required. And we're looking at about $1.3 million in airport capital. So we are looking at an ending balance the end of next fiscal year of about $4.7 million in our account. Just a brief overview of some of the projects that we are looking to budget for next year, and this would include some additional federal and state grant funding to the tune of approximately $5.5 million if that funding becomes available. As I just mentioned a minute ago, we have a couple of challenges that we're working with. One of them is this state aviation funding that is being held up in the legislature right now and is not being dispersed to airports for pavement preservation. In addition to that, they are looking to potentially divert some of that aviation money over to the state's general fund, which can have an impact on the amount of state funding that we could receive or be eligible for other capital improvement projects. So what we are needing to do is we are needing to plan for our own survival here and basically look to self-fund these particular projects with airport revenues that are generated by new leases and by increased user fees. A second challenge, and this is just an ongoing challenge that we face, is that both the federal and the state grant funds are all discretionary at this point. Therefore, we are having to compete with other airports across the United States, other airports within this region, and other airports within the state of Arizona to receive funding for our various capital improvement projects. the potential impact here of some of the projects that we are requesting be budgeted for next year is obviously very contingent upon those federal and state funds becoming available. And so our solution to that is, first of all, to try to plan for capital improvement projects that will compete well with the other airports, particularly safety projects are the top priority. We also are continuing to communicate with the FAA about Falcon Field's role in the national aviation system. And that is an ongoing thing because they've had a lot of turnover in the FAA, and so we're needing to re-educate some people about the fact that Falcon Field is indeed a player in this business. And if for whatever reason those funds are not made available to us in the next fiscal year, then obviously what we will do is we will postpone those projects until the funding does become available. Our key priorities for next year are, obviously, we're here to serve the public. So that's our first priority, is to continue to do that. Some of the ways that we intend to do that are to continue to maintain and provide a safe airfield. And I emphasize the word safe because that's what aviation is all about. Our goal is to keep up with the growing demand that we're seeing for aviation services, particularly at Falcon Field, to construct major safety and capacity-related capital improvements, work with the property owners to the west of us. We're looking to develop some property just west of Greenfield that the airport owns, and it's absolutely imperative that we work with the nearby property owners to make sure that that's compatible with what they would like to see. And last but not least, we need to help and facilitate the construction of the developments for the new as well as the existing tenants, because we still have quite a few tenants on the airport that are doing quite well, and they are in an expansion mode of needing more space for their operations. So the bottom line is that there's still a job to be done, and we're excited about next year, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you might have.
Okay. Any questions?
Okay.
Excellent job.
Thank you very much.
All right. Hear a presentation and discuss solid waste budget issues.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. My name is Willie Black. I'm the Director for Solid Waste, and this is Erin Romaine, who's our Management Assistant. She's going to be helping me with our budget presentation this morning. Our mission for Solid Waste is we're committed to providing excellence in the delivery of solid waste services to Mesa's residents, businesses, and visitors. Just a review of our solid waste programs and services in case you needed a reminder. We have a curbside collection program. We're 100% automated. We continue with the pay-as-you-throw philosophy with a smaller 60-gallon barrel available at a reduced fee for customers. We have front-load collection service that's available, and we compete with the commercial businesses for this, and we continue to service approximately 40% of the open market today. We also have roll-off and trash disposal available for businesses and residents in Mesa who are looking for an alternative for material that won't fit into the regular bins or barrels that we offer. We also offer bulk item and appliance curbside pickup. These are both scheduled services that are provided at a cost to the customer. We have a household hazardous waste collection event. They're held four times a year, and we partner with environmental programs for the events. And out of the household hazardous waste program, we also have a paint reuse program. The latex paint that's collected at the events is mixed into some actually good-looking colors and used for beautification projects throughout the city. We also have a clean sweep and green sweep program. This is a cleanup program that keeps the material off the curb and still allows customers to dispose of material in a convenient manner. Our Christmas tree recycling that's available after Christmas, we have drop-off locations spread throughout the city to be convenient for the customers. We partner with the Salt River Landfill on this project, and they accept the trees from us at no charge. We also have a residential landfill use program. This is an additional disposal option for our customers who have more debris to dispose of and don't want to use the other options that I mentioned above. We also have a drop-off recycling program. We have two locations placed throughout the city. They're for our multifamily communities to recycle and help divert material from the landfill. We'll move on to our solid waste budget. Taking a look at the revenue line, revenues are expected to be up moderately above budget, driven in large part by recycling revenue. Expenses are up due to increase in personnel, equipment costs, and capital purchases for the year. And if you take a look at our net income was budgeted to be lower this year due to increases in budget expenses. However, we're projected to come in $2 million over what was budgeted for our department. The largest expense for our department is personnel services, followed by equipment usage, and then our next is landfill disposal fees. As you can see, costs continue to rise for disposal, which makes recycling more attractive since the market is doing great. We still have a commitment for 85% of our trash to go to Salt River Landfill. The remaining 15% is spread to three other disposal sites, and we base the decision on where the material goes off of time, miles, and price per ton. If you move down to recycling revenue, currently we're getting just over $38 a ton for the material, and this varies monthly according to the current market value. Currently, we're seeing record prices for the material. Last year at this time, we were seeing about $24 a ton. And this is driven right now by the Asian market. Everything's so strong overseas with the Beijing Olympics in August. It's all driven by that. And they're expecting after the Olympics in August that we'll see the market drop a little bit, but we should steady off and still have some good revenue coming in. Some of the savings that we're planning for this year, we continue to hold growth positions vacant. We budgeted for 1.4% growth for the year, and by the end of the year, we'll probably see about half of that for growth in the east side. We continue to realize vacancy savings from the hiring process in addition to reductions in overtime every month. We're just under about $700,000 in savings. We manage our routes. I like to call it just-in-time routing, and what does it mean? It's just like doing a just-in-time inventory. What we've always done in solid waste is when our winter visitors come to town, we add routes so that we can provide the service, and when they leave, we remove the routes. The same thing with the green waste growing season. When the green waste season is there and we have more barrels set out, we add trucks so that we can handle the increase, and when the season's gone, we take the trucks away. We've saved about $41,000 so far this year by doing that. Something that's unique to what we've seen this year, late in 2007, we started seeing a decline in residential tonnage and a reduction in the number of trash barrels set out for service. Typically, in a downturn in the economy, what you see is people going out to dinner less and spending less money, so the commercial business starts to drop down. And people are eating more at home, so you see the residential trash rise. We didn't see that this time. This time, we're seeing a decrease in the residential trash in addition to the commercial. And we felt this is related to the housing crunch and looking at making cuts to our existing trash routes. I've been with the city for over 25 years, and this is the first time I've ever seen that. We've never reduced routes in existing areas. How we reacted to it, we communicated this to our employees and reduced the number of routes by two in Zone 1, which is the west side of Mesa. We're now looking at Zone 2, Central Mesa, for the possibility of reducing two more additional trash routes. Assuming we can make all the reductions, we can save an additional $22,000 per route for the rest of the fiscal year. In solid waste, we had growth purchases planned for this year, and in the roll-off business, we started seeing a drop in the number of sets we were making for the roll-offs, which is an indication our business is coming down, and what we did is we canceled the order on a growth roll-off vehicle to save the money. Additionally, in our front load area, we were planning on seeing additional growth in that area, and we planned about $299,000 in additional bin purchases. And since we're not seeing the growth, we've canceled the purchases on those bins. Our tonnage savings, I mentioned our tonnage going down. We're looking at savings so far this year about $220,000. Although we weren't asked to make any budget cuts or cuts to our budget since we're an enterprise fund, what we do have to look at is that expenses are continuing to rise in the revenue. So we made a few adjustments. We're eliminating a total of four positions. These are vacant positions in solid waste. The two equipment operator two positions I spoke of earlier that we're holding, We're actually going to be eliminating those positions next year, and hopefully we'll see the growth the year after, and we'll be able to add the positions later. We're eliminating two additional growth positions. One was in our quality assurance area, and the other was in our routing specialist. And what we're actually doing is we're going to fund a GPS and vehicle inspection system with that. Some of the things we're looking for this GPS and inspection system is improved efficiencies on our routing, the increase in efficiencies for the operator on the route, keeping in mind our vehicles get about 2.5 miles to the gallon, so every mile that we save saves a lot of money for the city. We can provide confirmation to a customer that the container was serviced, possibly recovering lost dollars for special pickups. We can reduce idle time for our vehicles. Even when the vehicle's idle, they burn up a lot of fuel. We can confirm that the route has been completed before the truck even came back into the service center. And we can ensure that the vehicles are operating at a safe speed. Something else that's really important to us is knowing the location of our vehicles at all times. It's for the safety of our operators. Our trucks are equipped with two-way radios, and they have a nice feature where you can press a panic button in case of an emergency, whether you had an accident, emergency yourself, whatever. The problem with this system is once the operator presses the button, that's it. Unless you really know where they're at, you can't find them. So the GPS will be able to help us find the truck. For vehicle inspections, our commercial drivers are required by law to inspect the vehicles twice a day, once in the morning for a pre-trip and a post-trip inspection. It's a paper process that we use right now. And what this goes is to a paperless process, and we can actually confirm from the office that the inspection's been done, and we can determine how long the inspection took to make sure a quality inspection was completed. These are just a few things that we're looking for with the new program. We're also expecting an additional $150,000 in savings on our landfill fees from what we have budgeted right now. And this is taking a huge assumption that our monsoon season won't be, it'll continue not to be any good. And we're going to see the continued trend in the housing market that we're seeing today. Now we'll actually get to good news. This number that you see here represents what does not go into the trash barrels, therefore it's what's diverted from the landfill. The green bar represents 0506, the red bar, the blue bar represents 0607, and the red bar is 0708. The increase you see is the efforts from our recycling outreach campaigns, and our goal over the next 5 years is a 35% diversion rate. And the next graph puts it into money perspective here. Here's a graph that shows the financial benefit for the recycling. The red bar represents the savings we receive from the material that's diverted from the landfill through avoided tipping fees from our blue and green barrels. The blue bar represents the revenue received from the material in the blue barrel, and the yellow is the combination of the two. As you can see, the revenue continues to climb. This year, we're expecting the benefit to be in excess of $2 million for the city. The benefit I mentioned on the previous graph is the reason why recycling outreach is so important. A couple of campaigns that I'm sure you've seen on Channel 11 is our No Plastic Bags in the Blue Barrel. This is important to our material recovery facility as there's no market for the bags right now. And additionally, when the bags go through the system, they tend to clog the machines. The other one is the Barrel Basics video that we've done. And Barrel Basics is just what it is. What do I do with the material? Well, it tells the customer how to take care of the material and how to put the barrel out to the curb properly for us. We also partner with MCC and Mesa Public Schools for campus recycling, and we're also doing education in Mesa Public Schools, and we're doing the same type of program that is in the homes. This way the students can go home and educate their families on what goes into the blue barrel at home. Hohokam Stadium, our training spring training, we have recycling barrels there. It's actually become a popular event. This is our second year we've been at spring training. And the same thing, more customers, when they go to events, they want to see recycling when they go there, and then the reminder when they go back home to recycle. Our East Mesa Service Center drop-off location now accepts plastics. Actually, what we did at the East Mesa Service Center was a test. We used to get a lot of contamination on the ground with everything that people wanted to recycle. They just dumped it on the ground and expected us to pick it up and recycle it. And what we did is we refurbished the site, made it more attractive to go to the site, and we placed blue barrels there. So the multifamily communities can just place everything in the blue barrels just like a regular resident does. And the sites actually look good today. We're actually going to be changing the Dobson Ranch site to look the same way and hoping that we have the same success there that we've had at the East Mesa Service Center. You've probably seen our new truck signs where we've done themed promotions, and what we're trying to do is revitalize our recycling program. Instead of the same message going out, we want to change it up a little bit and get people looking and thinking about the recycling message. Our clean sweep and green sweep program, the new rate of 27 cents a home was put in effect in September of 2007. The containers we use for two purposes. We allocate the containers for Building Strong Neighborhoods program, and the rest is available for neighborhood cleanups. From July of 07 to January of 08, we've collected 1,156 tons out of neighborhoods. 27% of that was Building Strong Neighborhoods, and the remainder was neighborhood cleanups. That compares to last year at only 557 tons. Some enhancements we made to the program, or one of the enhancements we made actually at the request of one of the council members, was to try to recycle some material from the containers. And what we've tried to do is set boxes for tires with rims, and scrap metal. And they've actually been pretty popular, with the exception of scrap metal, since scrap metal is going for about $210 a ton. Anything that goes in there, somebody else is helping themselves to. And of course, one of the really important things for us is how we're doing in our residential operation. Each year we present to council our costs based on the Phoenix model for managed competition. This is a measurement used to measure our efficiencies in the residential collection operation. We compare the actual average cost per household per month for the previous fiscal year. We use this number to compare it to the bids that are obtained in the city of Phoenix. This chart shows the current cost paid to Allied Waste for 06-07 of $563 per home, and we came in at $512 per home. Our cost increased by 29 cents a home, and if you take a look at the benchmark, it actually went up 30 cents a home. The majority of our cost increase was related to fuel and capital costs. And I'll try to answer any questions. Anyone has questions?
Let me just follow up on your last slide on page 12, that we had talked about privatization and bidding,
yeah,
internal and external, so I'm glad that you're following with what the market is doing in Phoenix. And have you been able to get information on any other communities besides Phoenix? Are they publicizing what they're doing as a comparable fully loaded cost? Chandler
met with Waste Management actually this week, and the cost per home in Chandler is about $7 a home. Okay. That's what Waste Management's getting paid. In Goodyear, where they just went private, it's about $15 a home, and that includes the rebate on the recycling. Not knowing what they're using for their numbers, it's a tough comparison. Town of Superior just went out to bid, and Allied Waste won the contract, and that one's over $20 a home.
Okay. The question about landfill capacity at the Solver or Pima, what's the situation on it? When does that contract come back up? We also talked about buying a cell or some capacity, and is there any movement on actually acquiring a portion of the land out there for Mesa's disposal?
No, right now, Mayor and Council members, the Salt River Landfill, our current contract goes to 2015, and in February of 2011, we're going to sit down with the landfill and talk about the future. If the bioreactor is approved and they start using it, they're expecting the life of the landfill to go to 2025, possibly 2027. And they're looking at the future of even mining out some of the old cells and going through and doing the bioreactor in those cells as well. And our disposal sites that we used on the east side, 50-plus years capacity with those. Apache Junction Landfill is due to close 2018, but we're using a transfer station that transfers down south of Florence, and that one's got, I think, 100-plus years.
Is the Florence site been located yet? I thought it was still in
There's process. Two different sites. The Silver Bar is the one that they're looking to build a landfill there as a private, mm-hmm, trying to do that, and there's Cactus was the landfill that was built just south of Florence, and that's up and running.
All right, and there's one over by, the Butterfield Station location. I believe it has a fairly substantial capacity, too.
Yes, that's the one, Waste Management. That's got several years out there.
Yeah, like 50 or something.
50 plus.
Yeah, all right. Okay, thanks. Other questions on the Vice Mayor?
Thank you, and thanks for working on getting the recyclable things out of the clean sweep program. I really appreciate that. A couple of questions. First of all, plastic bags, you know, when you go to the grocery store and they say paper or plastic. My understanding from talking to Jack a couple of months ago is that the if you choose the paper bags that they have, that those actually are recyclable. I want to confirm that.
That's correct.
Okay, so if people choose to get paper bags when they're at the grocery store, they can put those in their blue barrel when they get it home rather than putting the plastic ones into the system.
Correct.
Second thing is, the plastic ones, you know, people can reuse those to tie their trash in. We have this you have to bag it thing,
bag
and so people think that they have to go out and buy additional plastic bags in order to bag it. But you could use the ones that you get from the grocery store, tie them up, and put those in. That meets the criteria.
That's correct.
This is one of those, you know, I'm the attorney, I already know the answer. You liking it, Debbie? I'm asking the questions because I want the people who are listening. This is really important. And I wonder if people really understand how much money they can save, not just today, but it's because of the things that the mayor was talking about. How much, you know, how soon do you have to go to a different landfill? How much gasoline cost is there going to a different landfill? If you have to build a transfer station, how much does it cost? All of those things come into play. It isn't just current, it isn't just how it impacts us currently, it's how it impacts us in the future. So let me go back to those plastic shopping bags for a moment. The city of Phoenix has entered into a partnership with some of the grocery stores to allow people to take them back to the grocery stores. I don't know what they're doing with those when they do that. Do you have any idea?
Mayor and Vice Mayor, that's what I'm actually looking into, because that's the same question I have, is if the MRF can't recycle it, where are they actually going to? And there's actually legislation that's been introduced that would require a fee when you went to the grocery store of 25 cents for plastic bags and 15 cents for paper. So it would encourage you to buy the canvas bag. And that's probably the best thing you could do to keep the material out is to purchase the canvas bag.
Of course, if the paper is recyclable, that isn't a negative to us. I mean, you know,
No, but for somebody who is watching their money, 15 cents for every bag, you're going to make sure that everything's in as few bags as possible.
I understand, but I'm looking at this from the perspective of if that law doesn't pass and I will tell you I have some heartburn with the paper bag side of it. But anyway, just the fact that people can recycle that brown paper bag really makes a difference. So if you could let us know when you find out what it is that they're doing, because for them to just collect it and then for them to put it in the trash makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And that's another component of things. I had my kids and grandkids here from California this week, and they said, why can't I put this plastic in your trash? In your recycling. They're very conscious about their recycling. Why can't I do this? And my answer to them was, the city of Mesa does not collect things for recycling purposes if we can't actually recycle them. We don't try and just make you feel good. Well, you put it in the blue barrel and now it's gonna go someplace, but we're actually just dumping it in the landfill. So could you comment on that for a minute, Willie?
What we do with our contract is we just have things in our contract that they can market, and there's a continued market for it. Now, there's things that might be placed in the blue barrel, like right now, rigid plastic, like the Rubbermaid plastic tubs. That's not acceptable in our program, but because they have a market for it, they're not calling that contamination. But we won't advertise that as something that's allowed in the program since there's not a long-term market for it.
So we're not advertising it, but if I put my rigid plastic in right now, it actually would help the city. Okay.
Right now.
And but we're not advertising it, but if it went in.
Today.
Today.
And as a follow-up to the plastic bags, not only will we find out where they go, but we're looking at possibly doing a partnership with the grocery stores about telling people where they can take the bags and possibly looking at if there's something we can do with promoting canvas bags.
I really appreciate your doing that as well. One of the things that somebody from another state told me was that they thought that those were being used in their area for the kinds of things that we do with the tires on the rubberized asphalt on the roads. I couldn't figure out how that worked, and so I wasn't clear that they were actually a good source of information, but I know you will get back to us and let us
we'll
know.
We'll follow
Thank
up on
you.
It.
What's the, I think I heard with shredded paper, if you have a paper shredder, and
Jack. Come on, Jack.
How do you
Is Jack going to leave the room?
You're supposed to leave it in the plastic bag or not leave it in
okay.
the plastic bag?
I actually did a test on this after the last meeting.
I did one, too, and I had little pieces of shred all over up and down the block. Is they, all right.
If you're using ahead. A cross-cut shredder, which is the best thing to use,
right.
the best thing you can do is to bag it. If it's bagged in a brown paper bag, it'll go through as with the old corrugated cardboard. If it's in a plastic bag, I actually watched this come off the conveyor. They pull it from the conveyor. That's one of the best chances to get it recycled. If you dump it loosely in your blue barrel, think of how small it is. I watched the colored paper just go through the conveyor. And the straight cuts, there's more of a chance if that's not bagged, or just as good of a chance if it's just placed in the blue barrel being recycled.
All right, so the answer was leave it in the plastic bag. And
plastic bag will work, and so will the paper bag if it's cross-cut material.
All right. Didn't even know paper bags fit in those, but maybe they do. Okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions? And I think it has been noted that you were the one presentation that did both sides of the paper.
Thank you.
All right. Item number 6 is appointment to boards and committees. We have one.
Approval.
We have a motion.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Any reports? All right. Scheduling of meetings and general information. Kyle.
We did have a successful trip to D.C., committee meetings and being up on the Hill yesterday. And I think Scott ought to report on the activity of his son yesterday, the special experience he had.
No, you're
going to
pull me into it?
No, I'm
going
to pull you into it.
Congressman Flake, we were chasing him around the Capitol because he was going to a vote. It was odd because we were chasing Congressman Flake around, getting our exercise, and then went to Congressman Mitchell, who served cookies. So I like the cookies, actually. But in chasing Congressman Flake, my son, I took my son with me, he's 14, got a picture with a congressman, and then he took him onto the House floor, gave him his voting card, and said, go ahead and vote on this one. Told him how to vote. Asked him which country we were suddenly at war with, but knowing my son, but we were, but he had the opportunity to go down to the House floor, which I thought was pretty neat. Opportunity for.
Got the name of post office.
And he got to miss school, too, which was great. Yeah, which would he loved too. But he's a straight-A student, so I'll take him.
Okay. Let's go to scheduling of meetings and general information. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a reminder, we do have our council meeting March 17th. We'll a study session council meeting. And then Thursday, March 20th, we have a study session at 7:30 a.m., and that will be followed by a general and economic development committee meeting. Thank okay. you.
The meetings and general information, how do you anticipate in the past, as we've had the transition of especially budget, obviously, meetings jointly with the to-be sworn in new council members? I know we've got mayor's runoff and one district runoff. How should we as a council do this transition? I guess I'm interested in knowing what's been on your mind as a city manager to get the information out, and as council members, mm-hmm. how we can best help if somebody needs some mentoring on especially other regional boards and committees and other things that we do that aren't really televised on Channel 11. So.
Sure. Thank you, Mayor. I've already contacted the council-elect members, and we invited them to the meeting today, of course, and appreciate Alex being here. And I've proposed to them that initially I'm going to follow up doing some one-on-one meetings with them to kind of outline maybe the schedule and kind of how things happen at the council level, and we will also, depending on their interest and time, we'll also begin immediately with the three council elects that we have doing some orientation about not only about how the city operates and how it's organized, but as you would suggest, Mayor, maybe we can bring in issues related to committees, regional assignments, and things like that. Natalie will be coordinating that out of my office to try to spend the next, 2 months, I guess, or so, till 3 months, till the June swearing in, and take advantage of the time that they have available to begin having those discussions, whether we're bringing in small group sessions with a variety of different departments, talking about budgets, talking about operations. So we're going to spend that time now doing that. And then as far as this opportunity, I think as you suggested, and I've mentioned it to all the council elects, is that we would invite them to come and participate in the discussions when we are reviewing items related to the budget. So.
Okay. The other aspect, I guess, is the boards and committees, because there's going to be several appointments that will take place at the end of the year for the following year on that. That's a little bit of a short fuse for I'm working with Heidi right now to go through what I think are the appropriate appointments. I guess we could have some input at some point on whether the new council wants to follow with those or change that slate. And the other has to do with the different regional, from AMWA to RPTA to Gateway to all of the different committee assignments, that typically the mayor is the point person on that or designee. So, and I know we've had several people that have filled in that capacity currently, and whether there's a continuation of that. And I'm not sure where that discussion normally takes place. I think there's an assumption that the mayor will be doing those, but that's something that also is going to have to be
discussed. Right, and I think what we'll have to do is, and appreciate asking some of our experienced, mature senior members of the council to kind of fill in that gap for now, and then as the new mayors come on.
Did you just call us old?
No, I was talking to these two.
These two.
Oh, okay.
He's calling me old. This is a joke.
That they could spill in there, Mayor, and then when we know who the mayor-elect is, I think that's a discussion that we would have to have with that individual about how they want to move forward in those assignments. But in the meantime, I think it would be good to have some involvement from members of the council, so at least we don't miss the opportunity to be at the table with an informed representative. I think that's the key component there.
And I think, I don't know if the Arizona League of Cities and Towns, whether we have a right to be on the board or if that's just Phoenix, but there's some, I'll have to get that list so that with term limits in Mesa, it's important that whoever is elected to, especially the mayor's position, step up right away and apply for those leadership positions, or you will never ascend through the ranks.
Mayor, specifically to your question, the appointment to the executive committee is actually done on a per member basis. That being said, there's an unwritten agreement that the largest seven cities in the state have a permanent seat on the executive committee. So I believe and we will certainly advocate that Mesa maintain its representation, whoever the mayor and new council decide that person may want to be to step up.
Right, and the importance of that has to do with that 08, 9, or 10 election for a statewide transportation election, because you could be talking about $25-50 billion, mm-hmm. and Mesa has to be at the table, and very quickly, to give their input into that. So that's the point I wanted to make.
Yeah, we can keep having these conversations, Mayor.
Right, okay. Number 9 is items from citizens present. Are there any requests to speak?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay. All right, second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned.